Welcome to Vox Vomitus, also known as Word Vomit.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest episode of Vox Vomitus, also known as Word Vomit. I am your host, Jennifer Ann Gordon, the author of the Kindle Award-winning novel Beautiful, Frightening, and Silent, as well as the Hotel series and Pretty Ugly. Joining me today, as always, is my co-hostess with the mostest, my Vox Vomitus vixen, Allison Martine, authoress of the Bourbon books, which include Dibs, Since September, and Move on Melinda. With us today is a guest we are very excited to talk to. It's Vera Kurian. And we are going to be talking about her new book, Never Saw Me Coming. Oh, flash the book for everyone. Welcome, Vera. Welcome to Vox Vomitus.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to start with just having you tell our viewers a little bit about yourself and then a little bit about Never Saw Me Coming.
Sure. So my name is Vera. I'm a social psychologist. I live in Washington, D.C., where I work. And this is my debut novel. And I also have a dog.
And that was my dog, Lord Tubby, saying, "Welcome, Vera."
I was going to say, is that Tubby barking? Because it was definitely a small dog.
That's Tubby. So Never Saw Me Coming is about Chloe, who is an 18-year-old incoming freshman to university in Washington, D.C. She is a diagnosed psychopath, and she's entering a special program at her university where 7 students who are psychopaths get to go to school for free in exchange for being in this program where they're being scientifically studied. But what she's really there to do is hunt down and kill a boy from her past. What she doesn't know is that someone around town is attempting to hunt down and kill the 7 psychopaths one by one. So she has to decide whether or not she can work with people to solve this mystery.
I loved this premise so, so much. And I will be honest, when I booked you for this show was so many months ago, and I forgot which book this was. So then when I picked it up, I didn't read the back of it. I didn't read anything. And I'm like, I wonder what this is going to be about. And like within like 2 pages, I was just like, oh my gosh. And then I like flipped to the back and I'm like, yes, it's the psychopath one.
Psychopath. Yeah.
Psychopath. It was great. Chloe as a character, I just love so, so much. She was both funny and, of course, weirdly charming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's something wrong with us, Jen, how much we both cheered when we're like, we get to read about a bunch of psychopaths. Yay! But I think most people respond that way because usually when you get a book, there's either psychopaths, usually the bad guy, mm-hmm. not necessarily the protagonist. When you get a bunch of them, and my favorite, when do you get to start romantically shipping psychopaths together?
Oh my god!
I mean, that's what this book is.
It was amazing.
Have I ever shipped psychopaths?
I'm sure we have, but never did I want psychopaths to hook up so much with each other. I wanted all the combos.
Well, and that also then started us discussing how you would cast the lead male psychopath, who you describe as alternatingly like a young yacht salesman, and very reserved and buttoned down and impeccably dressed and swimmer's body. And that was just way more than I needed to be off in my own little dreamland.
Yes. I mean, that's definitely like Chloe's, the way that she views Ben, it's like through her telescopic, which she's quite shallow, but also, of course, she's going to harp on a boy's beauty. She thinks he's beautiful.
Well, so you are a social psychologist. Mm-hmm. For those of us who went to school for theater, which is me, so talk about what a social psychologist is.
So it's such a broad field. It's the study of how personality or context can affect attitudes or behavior, which is so broad. It encompasses everything from like neuroimaging to dating and attachment to dieting behavior. I studied politics, so it's such a broad field.
Me too. I was a poli sci major and then went on to law school. So I joke the only kind of math I passed was, it was a social science class, but it was still math. So it was the stats, but for social science majors. So it was really light on any kind of actual computational models. And that's when all the professors admitted that none of them can do it either. And there's just one at the whole department who could, and they all make her do it. Of course, it's the one woman. They're like, yeah, make Liz do it. and she would have to treat everybody.
That was so my minor.
You don't really need to know.
My minor was like quantitative methods.
So nice.
Stats was the reason I became not a psychology major, because I really wanted to be. And then I was like, I'm going to have to take statistics.
Yeah.
Just wanted to somehow jump to abnormal psychology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You want to get to abnormal before going through the basics, but you kind of have to have the baseline there. But I love it because you work it into your book. So some of those things I recognize, like one of the very first experiments they do is the prisoner's dilemma.
Yeah.
And I'm going, that's first year of basic poli-sci. You start learning some of that stuff. Yes. I didn't ever take like a full minor, but my emphasis within the poli-sci was more the political theory. And I love that stuff. And I was still super disappointed because my last year I wanted to take an advanced game theory class, which I didn't look very carefully at, and it was open to undergrads, but it was really a grad level course. And so there were a few of us in there, and the very first day they're like, well, you need to be able to do all this advanced trigonometry and calculus. And I didn't get that far in high school math. And one of my friends is like, I can tutor you. And I'm like, I am a lost cause. I'm going to go take European history. Peace out. But I was intrigued by all of it. And you work it in so well, because even though you may only have it here and there in like those experiments, you have it as part of the plot, because that's what all of this is can we trust each other? And it's better if we work together, but it's in my self-interest maybe if I don't trust you.
Yeah, I mean, I actually mapped out for each scene what is each person's motivation, because these are people who manipulate and lie to each other constantly. So everyone's trying to manipulate someone else within each scene with different goals. And Chloe constantly has like a different scheme going every time.
Oh, and she loves scheming and her wardrobes.
Yeah. Yes. And her Peter Pan collar. Like, now I've got to be this person. I've got to be this person. I love that. I don't have the wardrobe to do that. You do, Jen.
I do have the wardrobe for that, but I'm not technically a psychopath.
Well,
one would hope.
She has not been diagnosed as such.
I have not been diagnosed as a psychopath.
Let's just go with that.
I have been called a psycho by some of my ex-boyfriends.
That's not the same. We all have. Come on now. Oh, Laurie Schoenfeld says, hey, everybody. So happy to see you all. Laurie, I raised my owl for you, dear.
Hello, Laurie.
Hello.
Laurie is a fellow thriller writer.
And wrote Little Owl, which is hence my nod to her with my little owl mug here. But I love that you had that in there, because everybody's motivation, and it was constantly shifting. It wasn't just like throughout the book, each one wants X, because one of the other main characters, we've talked a little bit about, you know, terrible Charles and Chloe, but the third in the main characters that we really get this great perspective of is Andre. And I just loved him, because I don't want to say too much about him, because I'm assuming some of these things are spoilers, but he's unusual in the group for a couple of reasons, including the fact that he's of the main characters, the only one who isn't white, and is like, okay, so how is this impacting me? And how do I have to be perceived? And how I have to come across, because I don't want to come across in a certain way because of societal expectations. What were some of your thoughts in writing him and his backstory?
So I don't think it's a spoiler to say that he's not a psychopath.
He's
pretending to be one to be in the program in exchange for the free tuition.
I will say, I kept hoping he was actually a psychopath.
Is he faking
everybody? Is he faking himself? I thought he was double faking.
It's a double double blind.
I was doing an interview with some British radio people, and they were talking about that, like, in exchange for tuition, I was like, yeah, in America,
we have
either $60,000 or going to school for in a psychopath program. I mean, I think for him, in some ways, the character was the hardest to write, because A, I'm writing outside of my race, and I want to do it right, and I don't want to be lazy or stereotypical about it. I wanted him to be a three-dimensional person with his own agenda. He's not the sidekick. He's not the funny one. He's not the like funny black friend. He gets kind of pulled into this like kind of, sort of a fish out of water situation. But also, because he's not a psychopath, a lot of readers will have to glom on to him as being like, this is the person whose mind is most similar to mine. Like, this is how I would think if I was in this situation.
Is it wrong that I associated with Chloe? That probably says something.
I think
a lot of people do too, especially women, where it's, I mean, this is a book that's about female rage, despite the fact that it's funny, but it's tapping into a lot of feelings that women have about these issues. I did the first major rewrite of this book during the Brett Kavanaugh hearing and like what women were talking about at the time about, you know, senators running away from women being like, I want to talk to you. And like, that's kind of the feeling of, I wanted to write a female protagonist who's like, I'm going to take matters into my own hands.
And because she's smart, one else will.
And she's efficient and she is going to do it. And I know that people, despite however repugnant murder is, are going to root for her. Because of her determination, but also like along the way, she's kind of like funny and charming.
She's funny and charming. She was also really good at planning things. So you have to like respect her for that. Like she's
way more organized than I am.
I know. I was like, I should take a more Chloe approach to like my writing process. And I like, it's 60 days. I have 60 days and I'm going to do this in 60 days.
I read a lot of thrillers and sometimes you see people commit these murders and you're like, well, I mean, the police would take 2 seconds to figure that out. So I wanted to be like, okay, literally, how could someone get away with a murder? And she's like, very methodical. I'm going to collect hairs. I'm going to do this. I'm going to use a burner and like all of these other things of like, let's have a reasonably intelligent person. How would they do this? As opposed to just like, let's kind of go along with the plot and
right. Like, let's just throw somebody down the stairs and we'll just say, And nobody will figure out who did it for 18 years.
Well, and that's one of my big pet peeves with a lot of thrillers is there will be a scene maybe that's glossed over or something. And we're going, well, wait, no, this couldn't have worked out. But they never tell us, so you can't actually poke holes in it. You're just expected to believe it. And there was no part of your book that ever went there. It was so methodical. I'm a little worried about you now, Vera, that you were so methodical with this.
I mean, I like to think it is, but you know, of course, there's going to be some reviewers who are like, I think there's a plot hole. And like, I tried to be very fair without cheating. I don't like to cheat as a writer to be like, this would be an easy way to like get out of this. But like, I do think all the major questions are answered. They're not necessarily answered formally by the police, but maybe in conversation. Like, it must have been the case that this had happened.
Well, especially when you have this group of psychopaths and they're always questioning each other and themselves. And how should I do this to make sure people see me in a certain light? And especially Chloe and Charles had such a really interesting dynamic where he would challenge her and he could see what she was doing. And she was like, does he see what I'm doing? And he's trying to trap me. Does he see what I'm doing? And he's fine with it. Does he see what I'm doing? And he makes him want to have sex with me. Like, it was just, and she was just a great character. I love some of like the pop culture funny references you did, your references to American Psycho. I just loved. Yes. I also like Andre being your one person of color character. When I think there's one line where he's just like, God, I hope I'm not like the black guy in every movie,
in every horror movie.
Not this time. Like, I think it's that it was that scene where he'd left, where he's leaving and he realizes it's later at night than he realized. And because he'd been so intentional about staying with groups, like, because it happens pretty early. This isn't a spoiler that people start dying and he's realizing, okay, I thought I came here just to get free tuition and now I've set myself up for a much worse situation. What did I just get myself into? And oh, hey, now I'm going to be in a horror movie. I didn't sign up for that. But he's actively thinking, never be alone. Oh, good. Sorority girls. Got to stay with the sorority girls, trying to stay in crowds as much as possible.
Yeah. And there's a scene where he's walking on the street at night and he's afraid. And there's a woman in front of him who's then afraid of him because he's black.
Yeah, he's like, I'm not the bad guy. I'm trying to stay near you.
I try to work in kind of sociopolitical issues without like hitting people over the head because I'm not a hit them over the head kind of writer. So some people pick up on those things and other people don't. And that's fine with me.
I'd be surprised if they didn't pick that up because I thought that was pretty clear, but it wasn't something where you'd be smacked over the head to the point where it pulled you out of the story. It would have just been part of, this is Andre's experience and he's used to that. And I know there was one point where the one thing you didn't say about it, and I was kind of glad you didn't, but I was waiting for it to go there, was he was wanting to put up his hood because he's like, I will feel safer with my hood up. But then he's like, oh, but I shouldn't because of my peripheral vision, which is true. And I can't drive with my hood up because of the same thing. I lose my peripheral vision. Yeah. But I was just thinking of the black man in the hood and what happens there. Mm-hmm. And he never spoke about that. But I was wondering if that was even part of his internal mental calculations of, can I have this up or not? And is it worth the risk?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, as a writer of color, sometimes I make a decision about to what extent I want to engage in a particular topic.
And you did it very well without being preachy. Mm-hmm. And of course, having it set in DC and also being set like on the backdrop of multiple political protests, mm-hmm. like we understood the environment without you having to say, oh, it's a really terrible time to be a young Black man in the yeah. United States who may or may not be associated with a crime.
Yeah. And I still like, it's still a thriller, but I also wanted there to be some leeway for Andre to like, have fun or like be a fun character without it being like everything is terrible, because this is kind of an escapist book, right? It's not going to win the National Book Award, but it's you know, people read books like this for fun, but also a little bit I want to touch on.
And what I loved that they were still very much college kids, whether they were psychopaths, whether there was a serial killer running rampant, they were still going to parties, getting stoned, having sex with people they probably shouldn't be having sex with. You know, they were having a college experience.
Yeah.
And maybe that was easier for the psychopaths because they were like, oh, somebody has died. I'm going to this party.
Yeah. And I mean, like, part of the reason I wrote this book is that I love college novels, and I always thought, oh, I would love to read a thriller that takes place on a college campus because it has that insular feeling. And then everyone is kind of like young and crazy and has bad judgment.
Which is always just bad judgment. Yeah, and it's fun to read about. It wasn't fun to like be that person who's like, mm-hmm. oh, I have such bad judgment and I'm making all the wrong decisions. I'm a train wreck all the time. But I feel like if I was a psychopath, it would have been much more fun because I'd be like, I'm a train wreck.
I mean, I'm sure Chloe doesn't think she has bad judgment. I mean, she's like, oh, I'm a straight A student. I mean, you know,
everything's fine. Everything's fine while she's like picking up stray hairs from like random bathrooms all over town.
She really did have, I mean, you can debate the morality of what she wants to do, but she's driven, she's organized, she's focused. And I love how even when things start going bad, she's like, how can I work this into my larger plot? Because mm-hmm. we find the first person who gets murdered before she has done what she wants to do. And she has like a timeline on things. And she's like, all right, how can I use this to my advantage? And I'm like, that's the kind of go-to attitude I like seeing, that instead of being, oh no, she's like,
And I'd specifically written the book sort of in response to a lot of thrillers I read about where there's a lead female character who's just sort of hapless and, you know, passive. And, you
and
know,
everything's happening to her.
Yeah. Her husband did something and she finds a clue and then asks him about it.
Because he died of a heart attack.
You know, and I wanted something like very contrary to that. I something agentic, and I think women want to read about that.
Yeah, I mean, I really
did. You achieved that.
Because it also had like these aspects of dark academia mixed with like, it was really funny. Like, it was just a very funny book about a serial killer and psychopaths.
You know, I didn't actually intend for it to be funny. It was just, I started writing it and I knew her character, and because she's judgmental, she would say snarky things. And then I was like, oh, I'll just kind of roll with it. And then sometimes I read things that she says and I still laugh at them, even though I wrote them.
That's a good sign. Funny.
That is a good sign.
Yeah. And I guess, I'm not going to, like, I'm kind of a funny person, so not to be immodest, but like that bleeds in there, whether I meant it to or not. And I think there's not a lot of humor in mysteries outside of cozies.
Right.
So I kind of like that this was like a very dark book that still had some humor in it.
Oh, Elisa von Schulman says, happy Thanksgiving, Vera and Vixens. Vera, how did the voice of Chloe come to you?
You know, I one day I had too much to drink and I went to get an ice cream sandwich and they didn't have any and I got embarrassed. So I ordered a cappuccino, which is like really bad because I'm not supposed to have caffeine. It made me crazy. So then I went home and I wrote a story that was, sort of a modern day crucible told through the perspective of a high school student. And it had that teenage voice. And then shortly after that, I started writing this book. So Chloe's just very, very voicey.
She is. Yeah,
and as soon as I figured out her character and also her humor and kind of her three dimensionality, I was able to get that really well. I mean, there's a lot of aspects to her personality that are very at the forefront, but also she's really not someone who's self-aware. And I hope that comes across in the book, where she's kind of unaware of, you know, she thinks that if she murders Will, it will make everything better.
Yeah. Though she can't feel happiness, I feel like she thinks, well, maybe that'll be like as close to happiness.
Yeah.
Or maybe, or like, that will be what causes me to feel happiness.
She just sort of assumes that, or like, you know, she's not sexually attracted to Chad until she thinks he might be a murderer. And then she's like, oh, I really want to sleep with him. She just doesn't understand why.
Look, we've all made those choices.
Well, and I love that it came from this place of drinking, needing ice cream, and then behaving in this way, that it's like, that does sound like a teenage kind of thing, like this place where you're being driven by desires rather than rationality. And in many ways, even though Chloe is very rational in things, she is being driven by desire rather than going, really, why should I spend my time or change where I'm going to school in order to do this? But it's like, nope, this is what I'm doing. This is my path. And she's so methodical about it, even including having these deadlines on it where she doesn't want to set things in motion too soon, or when things maybe don't go according to plans, like, oh, don't want it to happen just yet. It's like, well, why not?
Yeah.
Like, it's not time for phase three yet.
Exactly. Yeah. She's very regimented of, like, she wants things to fit into her time, and then gets frustrated if anything else gets in the way.
Well, I could totally see this being like a Netflix TV show.
Limited series.
Like, loved it. It had, you know, I love that young voice so much. And I just feel like I could
see. That's just because we want to cast the show, admit it.
But we also, we couldn't find we don't know the younger actors that much.
Me neither. I know. We're like 20 years too old for all the characters. Yeah.
So we were like, who would play Charles? And we were like, I don't know, that hot blonde vampire from True Blood?
Yeah, we're like, Alexander Skarsgård?
I'm like, I think he's like 50.
45.
Yes, if he was 18.
If he was 18.
Well, I don't really have any information on this front. I did sell the TV rights, and they are interested in pitching it as a streaming.
Well, tell them to call us for casting, and we'll promise to come up with some.
We'll
some
be like, Alexander Skarsgård's son.
Maybe? There's actually as many Skarsgårds.
I know.
There are, but
a Skarsgård.
We were talking. Is it Bill? Who's
Bill?
The one
is the one that you said was too creepy.
He is too creepy.
I do love him though.
I do too, but he doesn't fit for Charles. Because here's the thing about Charles is he doesn't look like a psychopath. And don't tell me Bill Skarsgård doesn't always look like a psychopath. No offense. I still think he's hot, but still,
I think that I have Scrivener and I have like character profiles, and I think for Charles I had Googled watch model.
Watch model
for a fancy watch. You had a picture of like a slightly sinister looking handsome man.
Yeah.
And that's,
oh my God. Watch model.
The other one we came up with, I don't know if you know who Aaron Tveit is.
I don't think so. Unless.
So I first saw him, I want to say I first saw him in Les Mis, but then he was also in Gossip Girl, but I didn't place it at the time. He was then on a USA show called Graceland, and he was recently in Schmigadoon. If anybody's seen Schmigadoon.
Now I want to know who this is.
Also, yeah. I saw him. He was in Moulin Rouge, Broadway musical.
As the lead in Moulin Rouge, and you sent me a clip for that, and I thank you for that. But
who
was
he in Les Mis?
In Les Mis, he was, okay, I can't pronounce the French. Enjolras. I can't pronounce that. But he's the one
with the flag.
He's the leader of the students.
I don't know how to pronounce that. And
but he's not Marius, and he's not Jean
Valjean.
Yeah,
the main political guy
in the movie version.
The main political guy, and he would be a good one. But again, he's too.
I determined old, that
he can play young.
He's way too old now, but I determined I don't think he can play a psychopath because he's so straight laced. I would have a hard time seeing him be evil.
But I saw him in Gossip Girl, and he was like the
bad cousin.
There? Yeah, he was like a political person.
A bad cousin. Yeah. Like, all I want is I think that the movie adaptation of Gone Girl was really good.
Yes.
Partially because she wrote the screenplay, but Rosamund Pike's performance in that, where she sometimes is just like, when she is dead in the eyes and doing, you know, what with a champagne bottle. I mean, that's just like perfect.
You're like, perfect, I need a younger version to do this. She's got to be like 18 years old.
She's going to be 18.
Yeah, someone who could be dead in the eyes, but then also be charming and then put on the Peter Pan collar and be the innocent girl and then, you know, all of the different faces.
I have an 11-year-old who could probably do it. Sorry, that's my oldest.
I'm like, But would you really want her to do some of those scenes?
Allison, no, I don't want her to do any of those scenes. I'm just saying she can be the dead in the eyes and still so very cute. And it's like, are you all right, child? No. And not just for Andre, I love him, and I'm going, okay, who would you have? And again, I don't know anybody in that age range. Everybody, all the actors I love are all aging up, and I'm going, yeah, no. Yeah, Donald Glover played a college student 15 years ago.
Yeah, I've definitely Googled like young boy with dimples. And the things that you Google when you're a writer.
Yeah. And you're like, and then you're like, not oh, being I didn't creepy. Mean boy.
I am not creepy. Yeah. I'm just looking for inspiration, okay?
Exactly.
Well, midway through our conversation of who should play Charles, I Googled because I couldn't think of anybody. I'm like, hot blonde actor.
Then we just determined we don't find blondes that attractive, even though Jen's married to one.
I'm very attracted to my husband, but yeah. And so we were like brainstorming. We were like, is Thor a blonde man?
We determined, I don't think he's hot when he's a blonde.
Oh.
Sorry, I like him when his hair is shorter. And then he got funny, right? Basically, I need the Taika Waititi version. And then I think Taika Waititi's hot, but he doesn't have a place in the show. Sorry.
No. Luckily, there'll be people who can do this for you.
They do it for a living, I think. I won't have any say.
You'll have any say. And then we'll know who young actors are again.
Well, and the other character, and we didn't talk about casting this, but the one that you and I talked about also, Jen, was Kristen, the girlfriend of the psychopath. And our thoughts about her and the kinds of things that...
I had so many thoughts about Kristen.
Really?
She was... Well, we don't want to give anything away
on the air.
So we'll have to wait till we're off.
Oh, but okay.
We had lots of thoughts about her and so many ideas. And I think it's one of the things that really works for your book, because there are a lot of thrillers I've read where it's so clearly telegraphed what's going to happen and who's going to do what, because they're giving clues, which you need to. But then there weren't other opportunities or other possible people. Whereas you had this set up in such a way that other than because Chloe was first person, and unless you were going to pull an unreliable narrator and go, just kidding, I was in three places at once, which you didn't do. So thank you. That's not a spoiler. I'm sure there's an author who's done that, that you had all these possible people and you really were turning each page going, can I trust this person? Is this account accurate? Should Chloe trust this person? Ooh, should Andre? Should any of these people sitting in the room trust each other? And they're all like doing this at each other. And, eating funnel cake cheeseburgers. So,
yeah, I definitely wanted there to be like, not really a locked room, but there's like, there's a set, list of people, and then people inevitably will point to one of them. I mean, as I was mentioning earlier before recording, I think the book is a little polarizing because of the ending where...
How so? Like, what kind of complaints are you getting? Are they saying that it's predictable? Are they saying that they didn't see it coming because it's in the title?
Some people say... I figured out the twist, which is interesting because there is no twist.
I was going to say, what twist? I really just felt so stupid ending, for a second. I'm like,
I think in thrillers, people assume the ending is a twist, but the ending is not a twist. This is a traditional mystery.
Okay, this gets back to the whole idea that if the story can continue another book, it could be it's a cliffhanger. That's not what a cliffhanger is. it's that kind of thing.
I think, like, I don't know if it was that they kind of wanted a more... banger ending, but the thing is, like, me as a writer, my brand, I do high concept, but I'm very old fashioned. I do character driven stuff. If there's a mystery, it's not gonna have like a crazy, twist ending, because that's just not me. And maybe people were expecting that.
Were they expecting like a soap opera style ending where it's like, oh, and this person has been masquerading as their own grandchild and whips off the latex mask?
I think so. And like, I definitely like, to me, this has kind of a Bond villain ending. I wanted that. And to me, I was kind of making fun of the idea of a twist at the end. And I think maybe some people didn't see or get that. And they kind of wanted the more crazy, it's the grandmother's secret kind of ending.
Yeah.
But that's just not me as a writer.
So before we wrap up, we still got some time. So this is your debut novel, and it's a smashing debut. So congratulations.
Thank you.
What was your process like? Like, did you obviously, you're a social psychologist. Mm-hmm. Have you been writing all this time? Is this your first novel that you've shopped? Is it one of
I was a short story writer for a very long period of time, like high school onwards, and then I wrote my first novel in 2013, which was pretty good. And I did attempt to get an agent for that. I had some close calls, but ultimately no. And then I wrote a science fiction book, which also got some close calls with agents. And I was supposed to be working on a revision of that when I got the idea for this, which I wrote very quickly. And that when I was writing it, I was like, if I can't get an agent for this, there's nothing I can write that will get an agent. So this was going to be like my last book that if I couldn't get an agent for, I would go back to exclusively writing short story, because I've actually been pretty successful at placing short stories, whereas getting an agent and getting a book deal is quite hard.
It is hard.
But I did.
This
I did
is why we agent. Talk about it. We
yeah. Just, and so I got an agent for this.
I saw in your acknowledgements, I think you were just like, thank you to my agent for, because you said you had like 300 rejections, which I'm sure is an exaggeration, but it always feels like 300.
It's not an exaggeration.
You shopped three different books, and it sounds like, what was the genre of the first book?
Because the first one was literary, and the second was literary, one was sci-fi, and then the second one was
sci-fi. Got it. So you probably were shopping three different groups of agents. So if you got rejections for each one, you can stack those up pretty quickly.
Oh yeah. I mean the first book probably got 200 something rejections and then so you have to be willing to put up with a lot of rejection. And then once we shopped this, it got snapped up right away.
See, I'm wondering if one of the rejections, you told the story of Chloe's voice, and I'm just wondering if like the ice cream and the drinking were following one of those rejections, because that seems like the proper response to those rejections, because I need
an ice cream sandwich.
Yeah, exactly.
There were many, many, many times where I was just like, really depressed, and should I just quit writing, and maybe I'm not a good writer, or like reading books that are published and being like, I don't know, I kind of think mine's better.
Vera, this is the whole plot of our show right now. We talk about like, look how great this is, and then we're like, let's talk about how terrible the process was.
The process
to getting to like this amazing thing.
Well, being a writer is one thing. Being a published author is a totally, you have to be a business person. You have to have a very thick skin. You have to do PR. You have to do social media. It's a whole other thing.
It's a whole bottle of bourbon. I was going to say a whole kettle of fish, but it came out bottle. And I swear this is just coffee. I clearly need more.
As far as we can tell.
I haven't had any booze.
It's coffee with rum in it.
It's peppermint mocha. I mean, literally, it's not even like...
The sugar and the caffeine in there would make me so buzzy and crazy that I would be like worse than being drunk.
This is why that I don't have caffeine.
I need the caffeine. No caffeine for Vera. No.
I don't do caffeine either. Every once in a while, like I teach and my students will bring me a coffee and I'm like, I'll have a little of it. And then like 2 seconds later, my heart's going crazy. And I'm like, am I having a panic attack? Why am I so sweaty? And I'm like, oh, it's just the caffeine. Calm yourself down.
And that's when Jen's like, everybody jitterbug. Jen's a dance teacher.
I'm a dance teacher.
She's like, no waltzing. We've got to go fast. Here we go. Next up, I'm curious. So you went literary, then science fiction, and then this one is a psychological thriller. Is there a reason you kept switching genres? Were you thinking I'll have a better in, or this is more my voice, or because now I'm like, I want to read your science fiction because I want to read
the literary.
Well, and I want to read literary too because I write literary science fiction, and then separately I write contemporary romance. And for me, the contemporary romance is out, my literary science fiction is not yet. So I'm curious, like, were you switching till you found something where it was more you, or did you just think that the business end of it, as far as getting in, like the door would be the easier door or the more welcoming door?
I wasn't really cognizant of it. I mean, when I first started writing short stories, they were kind of traditional modern realist.
Okay.
And then they started to become more strange, like a little more Italo Calvino or like Donald Bartham. And that, you know, it seemed natural that my first book would be a literary novel, although it was high concept. And then I took some of the characters from that book and then wrote a novella, which was a science fiction one. And then around that novella, I kind of made an entire world.
So you went literary into science fiction from the same characters.
Yeah. And that, the switch to the thriller was completely random. I think it's because I read a lot of thrillers. And then my next book will not be a thriller. It'll be a mystery. So
how different though are thrillers and mysteries? Because I think for me, they're on my same Goodreads shelf.
Yeah, I think they're quite different. I mean, a thriller has to be fast-paced.
It has to happen like in a certain amount of time.
And I think overwhelmingly a thriller is not about something happened, let's figure out what happened, but something is happening.
Ooh, okay.
Whereas a mystery is often something has happened, let's figure it out, like a traditional detective story.
And I think thrillers too, you can't have any kind of flashbacks. You're not like, it has to all be.
There's almost.
Are you remembering your rules, Jen?
I'm remembering my rules.
Yeah. Maybe two very short flashbacks in this book, but the chapters are so short and it's very like propulsive, which,
You're writing now or the one we just read?
The one you just read.
Yeah. I was going to say much though. It's for as long as it is. Cause I'm trying to remember, it was like 392 pages on the PDF. Yeah. Is that about right?
Yeah.
I looked at it and I'm like, ooh, I better start reading this because it's going to take a while. And then it didn't because it is that bingeable. Yeah. Ooh, I can just read one more. I can just do that. The Pringles.
I thought the same thing. I was like, oh gosh, I have to start it now so I get it done. And then I finished in a day and a half.
Right. Yeah. Because, you know, we read, we each read for each of our shows and then we each also have a separate show. So we usually have on average a book plus per week that we've got to be done on time. So parsing that out for it, it read faster than books that were 100 page shorter that had to read because of that pacing and the short chapters and
what's happening next. And then, I very much designed it to be read that way. And that now I'm kind of enjoying not having that structure where I can have a longer chapter. I can have flashbacks or have people kind of, taking their time. More
breathing.
Breathing. Well, and also the fact that you've got multiple points of view moved it very quickly because it's like you leave where Andre is and then you pick up and Charles is getting out of the pool and then it moves because you're like passing the baton between them. So it moves the story forward with a really intentional pacing and the countdown aspect that we're counting down to something, it just drives you forward. Yeah.
And I wanted to use the point of view to build mystery as opposed to using like tricks, like, you know, withholding or something.
So, I appreciate that. You know, I don't like withholding.
Where we don't know who knows what, and that's kind of propelling the story forward, or you get to see Andre's perspective on how Chloe appears through a different point of view. So I wanted to use that to build dramatic irony or to build tension.
It really worked. And what I was wondering if your editor or your agent or anyone said, because you do play with the POV, you had one person, you had Chloe, who was, it was first person and nobody else was in first person, which I just loved more than I thought I was going to love it. At first I'm like, why is Chloe the only one in first person? Did you get any pushback about that? Like, it's too weird. Why?
No. That's interesting you say that. I don't think I would ever write a book that had more than one first person point of view. I don't know if I can think of a book that does that effectively because often the narrators sound too similar.
Yes.
I've read it in rom-coms and it's not a thing I particularly like. It's the guy's view and the girl's view.
Yeah.
And you're right. Do they usually end up sounding like the same voice, but I have heard of people where it's a tag team writing where one is writing one POV and one's writing the other. Yep. So they do have different voices because you literally have two different authors doing that. But I hear what you're saying.
Sometimes it works and this is usually more in like historical fiction or even like historical mystery when it's like, it's set like 100 years apart from each other.
Yeah.
So it gets so different.
I was just thinking of Cloud Alice. I think more than one narrator is first person in that book. Maybe one is epistolic. But it never occurred to me to write any of the other point of views in first person. There was one other point of view that got cut. One of the other psychopaths, the very creepy one, was an initial.
Oh, I was just going to say, I didn't want to say his name.
Very creepy.
Very
gross.
I wouldn't have minded like one chapter of that.
I'm glad you left that out.
I think it was.
I like really dark, really gross. Oh, I'm like,
It was a gross masturbation scene.
Oh,
again, glad you left it out.
Yeah, I think
it's also one of those things where I here's the thing that I think you did so masterfully is that we have this stereotype about what a psychopath is, and you handle it from a, I don't want to say clinical because that sounds cold, but an academic point of view of these people aren't necessarily monsters. They have different wiring on how they process the world around them. And the whole point of this program they're in is to be able to function in this world that they maybe aren't cut out to do so without some kind of training and learning how to control impulses, etc. So they're doing that. And if you would have had something where this guy clearly is gross and creepy and a monster, it would have undercut that.
Yeah.
Because even though Chloe's off plotting a murder and terrible Charles, and Andre's not even a psychopath. If you would have had someone who's like, yeah, I'm doing a gross masturbation scene and he's super creeper, and we had his POV too, I think it would have pulled away from these other characters and how human and three-dimensional you made them.
Yeah, I definitely wanted 7 completely different psychopaths. I mean, I think often in novels where, say, someone has, say, depression, they're depicted as a textbook case.
Yeah.
The reality is people with the same diagnosis can be completely different. And they also have, like Chloe, for example, has a completely different perspective on her diagnosis than other people in the book that are diagnosed.
Exactly.
One person wants to get better. She thinks there's nothing wrong with her. If anything, she thinks she's better.
She's like, hey, look at my grades, and I'm going to be getting into med school. I'll do the dissection. This doesn't bother me.
Yeah, and I kind of think she would get into med school.
Well, I'm sure she would. I'd want her to be my doctor, honestly, because assuming that I didn't wrong her, there's nothing in Chloe's personality or the way she behaves that's like, I'm just out to cause trouble, or I just want to hurt other people. Like, she makes it really clear that the person that she's gunning for has like, and that's part of the reason it's so easy to empathize with her, because you wouldn't have to be a psychopath to want to take care of her, to be like, yeah, this guy needs to go. And you wouldn't have to be like, oh, I'm also psychopathic, to understand her motives and her intentionalities.
She has a moral compass of a sort. It's different than mine and yours, but she has rules that she's following.
Exactly.
I don't think she cares about morality, but she's not
right
going around killing people because she wants their Louis Vuitton.
And she's not doing it for fun.
No. And she's not a pleasure killer. And what she's doing, it really is the out for justice person. And she happens to be a psychopath. That's the difference versus just, oh, she's out just for, you know, this is how she gets her kicks.
Yeah. Right? She's not reveling in the violence. That's why I had the scene where she eats the Luna bar, and like the eating of the Luna bar is a very hollow action. I'm not negging on Luna bar.
I was going to say, like, I have a lemon blueberry one in my cabinet. Are you telling me that?
I actually, I didn't want it to be this, like, you know, walking away from fire in slow motion, but this is a little hollow.
You're going to have to tell Netflix they can't have that.
She can eat a Luna bar in slow motion.
Oh, and then we get product placement money from Luna bar.
Yes, exactly. And I will just say, when I was in school for theater in college, I went on this diet that I only ate Luna bars, and I lost a ton of weight.
That's
a terrible thing.
That's a good thing.
I know, it wasn't good, but I'm just saying.
I mean, there's a variety of flavors, but that's still not a complete diet, no matter how you spin it.
No, it wasn't.
No, not at all.
I'm not advocating for that, viewers, listeners. Don't just eat them as a supplement. And then unwrap them in slow motion.
Yes. And speaking of slow motion, so Vera, you were saying the big difference between mysteries and thrillers are you do have more time in your mystery to kind of breathe, as we say, eat your Luna bars more slowly, and do that. Do you have a release date for that one yet, or is it still
I haven't even pitched it to anyone. Kind of in the process.
Started it yet.
I've maybe written 10% of it. And I planned out a lot of it last year when I was just kind of in a holding pattern for this book to come out. And it has a pretty intricate plot line with a lot of characters. So I did a lot of just plotting and planning before I ever picked up the pen, which is typical for me, so that when I did pick up the pen, I actually write pretty quickly because I've plotted everything out and I know the characters like completely.
I love that. It's much more organized than I am.
I'm extremely organized. Yeah.
See, and that's good. It doesn't. I'm not shocked by that. I am in awe of it because I sit down at the computer and go, okay, I really don't know what this is going to be. Let's just see what happens. Mm-hmm. And then I kick myself because I'm like, I wonder if I had, like, if I knew what was going to happen, if it would be faster.
Yeah. I mean, I think part of it comes from, like, you know, working full time and being pretty busy of like, I only have so much time to write. So I'm going to use that time to just like knock out task. And then I have to go do my next, you know, activity or whatever.
Does your brainstorming ever happen while you're supposed to be doing something work related?
not really work related.
Don't admit it on camera, Vera.
Allegedly, when I'm like, walking the dog or like showering, lifting weights, when I'm kind of meandering around, I can't do only one thing. I have to constantly be. So there have been times where I'm listening to an audiobook and then I start thinking about my own thought.
Pause the audiobook and then
I've had to do that too. I'm like, I swear this is a good book. Pause, thinking my own thing.
Yeah, I mean, because for the most part, I tend to have most of it figured out in my head before I start writing it down.
That's awesome, right? Though, because you're right. If you have it all figured out, and then it's just a matter of getting each sentence to shine, rather than going, I don't know what the sentence is even supposed to say, or if it's leading to the right direction. It's a faster process.
Yeah. Well, like logical consistency is really important for me. And that also includes characters should not do something out of character.
Yes.
Unless it's in their character, not to be a tautology, but I hate in books when a character does something that's completely outside of, and it's only to serve the plot. Mm-hmm. So, I want it to be something that's internally consistent, which I think of as like not cheating.
No, that is cheating. That makes sense.
Yeah. I think Allison and I both come from a very character driven place when we write. Yep. So I feel like she and I might not know what our plots are in our books, but we really know who the players are. I know who's in my book. I don't know what the book is
about. They're doing.
I don't know what they're doing, but I know them, and I figure out once I know where they are, they'll tell me what they're doing.
Yeah.
It's true. And I think everybody has a different process, and that whole idea of like what would make it go faster, I think really varies from person to person, because I know if I was told, oh, you've got to plot all this out, I wouldn't get past anything, because until I let the character start breathing and just having full scenes in front of me, I don't know where it's going or what's happening. And I wish that I wasn't like that. I wish I could change things around, because I know the whole idea of like, oh, well, start outlining your next book. It doesn't work like that for me. And so I can start writing a book and then go, this isn't going anywhere I want it to, and have to kind of go, this is going to go off to the side, where you'd be like, oh, but couldn't you have just done a quick outline and go, this has no potential? It's like, no, because that's just not, that's not how this works. Yeah. If it works at all.
It works.
Sometimes.
On the days
that I'm for debate.
I know. You and I split that one brain.
So. I know. If you have it, mine doesn't work.
I know. Who's been using it the past week?
I don't know. It wasn't. Mine's just in full shutdown mode. I'll blame the turkey, but it's not the turkey. I'm the turkey.
Well, on that note, I think we should wrap up, because we have our Thanksgiving segue. Thank you, everybody who is watching this live. And thank you for people who are watching or listening on the replay. We are live on the eve before American Thanksgiving. So happy early Thanksgiving to everybody in the United States who is watching this.
We're too late, Vera, for Canadians. You guys already had yours.
They had theirs already. Thank you, Vera, for being here. Thank you for writing this book. Yes. We can't wait to read whatever you write next, whenever that may be, and binge watch your show when it's streaming someplace.
Yes.
Stay tuned, everyone. Next week, I'm going to have to use a cheater. Next week, when we have Jeffrey Cranor and Janina Mathewson with their book, You Feel It Just Below the Ribs. I knew I wouldn't be able to remember both of their names at the same time.
And the title is long.
Long title, two names. That's too much to expect from me on this late Wednesday night. Thank you, Pam Stack and Roman Sirotin, and everybody at the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. This has been a copywritten podcast, and we will see you all next week.